This is the last day of this December 2010 four-day session. And we'll continue reading from our text titled Zen Essence, which is translated and edited by Thomas Cleary. It's a collection of selections of various teachings of various Zen masters. We left off yesterday reading from the teachings of the Sung Dynasty master Dawi, and we'll continue with that. When you have no mind, Zen is easy to find. And then he explains, in Zen terminology, no-mindedness does not mean insensitivity or ignorance. It means that the mind is stable and does not get stirred up by the situations and circumstances one encounters. It means the mind does not grasp anything. It is clear in all situations, unimpeded and undefiled, not dwelling on anything, even on non-defilement. Yeah, this is a word that probably is not in any English dictionary, no-mindedness, but it's exactly what we are approaching in our practice, especially when we're doing lots of zazen. Basically, it means a mind of no thought, of detachment from thoughts. And it's anything but means anything but insensitivity or ignorance. To be no-minded is to be wide open, receptive, alert, attuned to things around us, to people around us. How does this work? Because no-mindedness means no-selfness. We're not in a cocoon of thoughts that separates us from the environment, from others and the environment. Monk once asked Zen Master Joshu, what is the true Joshu? And he said, North Gate, South Gate, West Gate, East Gate. To be in a state of no-mindedness is a state of responsiveness. We're not setting ourselves apart. We're not setting ourselves against. It's really a no state. What we call a state of no-mindedness is not a state. It is the absence of states of mind. It is freedom. It's no-mindedness. It's like water. In Japan, the word for a novice monk is unsui. Unsui means cloud, water, clouds and water. The reason that clouds and water are so admired in Zen is because they have this no-minded quality. They flow with circumstances. They adapt. Water always adapts, accommodates itself to the shape of its container. Clouds and water have this selfless quality of infinite adaptability. That's no-mindedness. This is what we can experience in different degrees when doing a lot of zazen, such as in sesshin. This fluidity, Non-attachment is another word for no-mindedness. Here's another selection. Good and bad come from your own mind. But what do you call your own mind, apart from your actions and thoughts? Where does your own mind come from? If you really know where your own mind comes from, boundless obstacles caused by your own actions will be cleared all at once. After that, all sorts of extraordinary possibilities will come to you without your seeking them. So what about that? Where does your mind come from? Well, in place of that question, we have these others that we commonly work on in Zen. What is it? Who am I? What is Mu? They all take us to the same place, to this source of mind. Which is the realm of no mind. In ancient times, Zen teaching was sometimes abstract, sometimes concrete, sometimes based on a particular time, sometimes transcendental. There was no fixed standard at all. Well, because true Zen teaching is the functioning of no mind, and in that functioning there is no attachment to this or that, to any of these dichotomies. Now, it's true that by and large, Zen teaching uses a lot of concrete imagery. Certainly the koans do. Concrete meaning the physical. But we know there are also texts with very abstract concepts that are presented. I think we're going to run into some of those this morning in another later selection. Everything depends on the circumstances and the moment. Sometimes the concrete is best suited for the circumstances. Sometimes the circumstances call for more abstract use of words. Sometimes we need to be very specific in time and or even contemporary. Sometimes we want to speak in terms of what is beyond time, the eternal, the timeless. There is ultimately no right or wrong in how Zen is presented, so long as it is authentic to the time and the place. It comes out of something genuine, specific to that time and place. And when working with a student, to that student, or working with a teacher, to that teacher. And then here's another one that's along the same lines. If you think there are any verbal formulations that are special, mysterious secrets to be transmitted, this is not real Zen. To these questions, these basic questions we just mentioned, there's no answer in the ordinary sense. in the dualistic sense of question and answer. There's no, if there were an answer, it'd be something you could write down. And of course it isn't, because it's not an abstraction. To resolve these questions means to be fully authentic to the time and place. So there is no formulation that would work. That's what is so funny about this genre of cartoons, where the aspirant is scrambling up the mountain and the vast reaches of the Himalayas, and they see the holy man sitting there, and then him coming out with some answer. It's preposterous, because if there were an answer, then we could just pass it on to one another and be done with it. The so-called answer, the resolution to these questions, these existential matters, has to be one's own. And that has nothing to do with words. Many people who practice Zen are in a burning rush to learn Zen when their worldly affairs are not to their satisfaction, but then give up Zen when they become successful in the world. So it is. I see this all the time. Students, people come to practice in a state of unrest or dissatisfaction, something is not working out for them in their life. Maybe it's their work, maybe it's their in a relationship, or a matter of health. And in that state of dissatisfaction, then you have something you can work with. You've got someone who is searching, they're looking for a way out of their suffering. And then something very vital comes from that. But then, too often, not always, but too often, when things clear up, when they find a new lover, or a new job, or their health clears up, then the motivation subsides, and they have less interest in practice. So why so many people, one reason why so many people begin Zen practice but so few follow through for any great length of time. It's true in, I've heard in Japan too, it's probably true everywhere, that there's this key moment, this opening, where one really is looking. And then when circumstances change, sometimes that opening closes up. Until then, one breaks up with the new partner, or loses the job, or gets into quarrels with someone. Then there can be, again, the rekindling of the interest in that which is beyond change. That's really what it comes down to. When conditions go against us, okay, good, let's find something that is beyond conditions, the spiritual. And then the real measure of someone's aspiration is when conditions change for the better, it's not enough. One recognizes that, as it's said in I read somewhere in Asia, the price of gold rises and falls, but the nature of gold remains ever the same. The nature of gold and its price is fluctuating, it's change. Change is arguably the ultimate human challenge, is dealing with change. What is beyond change? What is the changelessness, the eternal, within change? What is Mu? What is it? I always have mixed feelings when I hear about a Sangha romance. Of course, part of me is delighted in their giddy happiness at finding someone they're crazy about. But then mixed in with that is this concern that they not bank on that person to deliver them any kind of lasting happiness. Starting with the fact that that person won't always be around. Sooner or later, that person will be gone. And even long before that, there can be all kinds of other problems with that person who seemingly is one's source of happiness. It's the same, actually, with one's practice. When things are going well, someone reports in Doksan, perhaps, that things are going really well and they're in a great state and everything is coming together. And great, that's great. But don't count on that lasting the way it is. Because it won't. What is beyond the ups and downs? What is beyond the favorable and the unfavorable? Here's another topic. When you have attained mental and physical peace and quiet, don't get stuck in peace and quiet. Be independent and free, like a gourd rolling and bobbing on a river. Well, there's that same image of fluidity and adaptability. Other teachers have also used that image of a gourd floating along effortlessly, buoyed by the currents. Always there's this danger in meditation of sinking into a state of dead stillness, torpor. In Buddhism, there's this phrase called the near enemy. So, for example, the near enemy of compassion is sentimentality or pity. In other words, it can be mistaken. Sentimentality or pity can be mistaken for compassion, but it's not. And if it is mistaken for it, then it interferes with, it blocks the development of true compassion. And it's the same with this state of peace and quiet that we always can find our way into some measure of peace and quiet when we're doing a lot of zazen. But it can't compare to the true inner rest, state of profound rest that is beyond these vagaries, these changes of activity and rest. Can become, we can fall, when we're doing a lot of zazen, we can fall under the spell of quietness. The reason that we must never settle for that is because it is based on those conditions, such as in Sesshin, these ideal conditions of silence and solitude and all of the sitting. But those conditions change. We emerge from Sesshin. We throw ourselves back into the world of activity and conflict and disagreements with people. Where's the silence then? The only way to attain true, unconditional stillness of mind is to break through this discriminating consciousness, to have a breakthrough, an awakening that reveals what is beyond all these changes, the source of all these changes. That's what he means when he says, be independent and free. That is, not dependent on perfect conditions. Zen Master Hakuin, more than anyone that I'm aware of from the texts that have been translated into English, Hakuin is constantly inveighing against this dead, sitting, and silent illumination, warning that the quietude of meditation can be tantalizing like honey. It's not nothing. It's wonderful in its own way, but we have to recognize how it is based on, is dependent on conditions. Not get attached to it. That's the problem. One form this takes, this attachment, is people who complain about the noise during Sesshin, the sound of the stick and the Doksan bell and the running and so forth. And if that's too much for you, if you can't take that relatively moderate interruption of dead stillness, then your chances of making this practice really function for you in a really effective way, an adaptive way in your daily life, are very slim. We must be able to work with all kinds of conditions and find even in commotion, find a way to keep our minds at rest, centered. Those things, those doksan and the stick and all these activities also prevent us. They're not only a test about our state of mind, but they also prevent us from sinking into this mud of false quietude. Here's a longer one. People are backwards, ignorant of the true self. They pursue things, willingly suffering immeasurable pain in their greed for a little bit of pleasure. So fill in the blank. What would that be in your case? Greed for a little bit of pleasure. Food, sex, sleep. Substances. In the mornings, before they've opened their eyes and gotten out of bed, when they're still only half awake, their minds are already flying about in confusion, flowing along with random thoughts. Although good and bad deeds have not yet appeared, heaven and hell are already formed in their hearts before they even get out of bed. By the time they go into action, the seeds of heaven and hell are already implanted in their minds. The Buddha said, all faculties of sense are receptacles manifested by your own mind. Here we get into some of those abstract terms that alluded to earlier. All faculties of sense are receptacles manifested by your own mind. Physical bodies are manifestations of your own mind's representations of forms as subjectively imagined. I'm not sure I can even sift through all this, but the basic idea is what we talked about earlier in Sesshin, is the ways in which we allow our own subjective consciousness to distort and color our experiences. These manifestations are like the flow of a river, like seeds, like a lamp, like wind, passing away from instant to instant. Frenetic activity, attraction to impure things, and voracity, greed, are the causes of the useless, deceptive habits that seem to have always existed, like a water wheel always turning. Whoa. The useless, deceptive habits that seem to have always existed. Half of practice, Zen practice, is just catching on to these habits, noticing them, owning them, being able to recognize them as they arise in the mind over and over and over again. These habits, not just what we think of as ordinary physical habits, but mental habits, mental reactions, tendencies, emotional tendencies, the things that we keep getting snagged by. In a way, this whole practice is about overcoming these habits, setting down new grooves, not being driven by what we've always been driven by. The meditation provides the space in which we can reset ourselves, which we can get new purchase on our ability to not succumb to these habits. It is a kind of a clearing of the screen where we can again start over and try again not to succumb to these things. we discover in our practice that we keep getting another chance. No matter how many times we blow it, we keep getting another chance. We keep getting new choices, another shot at it. Okay, this time I'm not going to snap at that person. Instead, I've done it a million times, but this time, no, I don't have to. I have a choice. This time I'm not going to just follow the path of least resistance and get involved with this person who I know it's not healthy for me to get involved with in the way that I tend to get involved with people. I don't have to do that. Keep doing that. Space. Say space is not really something that we have to create. Our mind is space. That's its nature. It's full of space, full of openness. If we can just let thoughts settle, then we can start to access these open spaces and breathe again and get started anew. Continues, if you really see through this, you know that heaven and hell are nowhere else but in the heart of the half-awake individual about to get out of bed. They do not come from outside. And then he continues, while in the process of waking up, you should really pay attention. While you are paying attention, you should not make any effort to struggle with whatever is going on in your mind. While struggling, you waste energy. As the third ancestor of Zen said, attempts to stop activity will fill you with activity. We know that one. While struggling, you waste energy. This is what Errol was talking about earlier in Sesshin about being able to relax and not oppose. Zen is non-oppositional. We're not trying to fight anything. In the case of bad habits, we're not fighting. That won't work to fight bad habits. Instead, what it really means is to refrain from repeating the bad habits. We're not opposing the bad habits. We're just not doing them. We're detaching from them. And of course, it's very difficult. But opposing them, battling them, is not a good strategy. And an unnecessary one. We don't need to oppose these forces in the mind. We just need to not get involved with them, to withdraw our involvement, our attention in these things. While struggling, you waste energy. There's that energy thing that we came across a couple days ago that is so common in Chinese Zen texts. We want to work with our energy. We want to unbind this tremendous energy that we have that is part of the space, this vast space, spaciousness of the mind in its natural state. And then he finishes, when you notice that you are saving energy in the midst of the mundane stress of daily affairs, this is where you gain energy. This is where you attain Buddhahood. This is where you turn hell into heaven. So it's a certain vocabulary, this speaking of things in terms of energy. It reminds me of Taoist texts. There is a lot of Taoism in Zen. Again, it's always whenever we may wonder, okay, how again am I supposed to deal with these habits based on thoughts, repetitive thoughts and notions that hold my mind in their grip? How am I supposed to work with this? I'm not supposed to struggle. No-mindedness, letting go of the thoughts, letting go of the self, becoming like clouds and water, not opposing, yielding, adapting. It's also very Taoist, but it's just intelligence. There's a time and a place to stand firm, and there are probably many other times and places to yield, to adapt. Which really means, adapting really means relinquishing one's stubborn notions about the way things should be. Or relinquishing one's preferences is mostly what it is. The way we want things to be, the way we want people to be. This is where we keep getting into trouble. Here's a very short one about shortcuts. When you have even a single thought of looking for a shortcut in Zen, you have already stuck your head in a bowl of glue. Why? Because the thought of looking for a shortcut is an obstructive thought. It's also another preference. I want it now. I want it as soon as possible. There's the I. The I is very strong when we're looking for a shortcut. I don't want to take the time to do such and such. I want it now. There's so much ego in that. And that's what blocks us. People have been used by the mind's conceptual consciousness since before they can remember, flowing in the waves of birth and death, unable to be independent. If they want to leave birth and death, to be joyfully alive, they must cut through decisively, stopping the course of mind's conceptual consciousness. Just a long way of saying we have to learn to detach from our thoughts, to let go of the thoughts. Well, we've come to the end of this chapter, so it's time to stop and recite the four vows.